Neither can I.
Good. So, here's a big question. A year from now, where will Drew Gamble be?
A mile passed as he considered this. There are three possible answers, all dictated by what happens at trial. One, he's found guilty of capital murder, which is likely because there's no doubt about what happened, and he's sent to Parchman to await an execution. It might be possible to pull strings and get him placed in some type of protective custody because of his age and size, but it will still be a horrible place. They'll probably place him on the actual death row, where he might be safer because he'll be in solitary confinement.
And his appeals?
They'll go on forever. If he's convicted, I suspect I'll still be writing briefs for him when Hannah's in college. Number two, he's found not guilty by reason of insanity, which is unlikely. If so, he'll probably be put in a treatment facility for an undetermined length of time and eventually released. I'm sure the Gambles will flee the area, and we might be right behind them.
That doesn't really seem fair either. Great for them, terrible for the Kofers. We're caught in the middle.
True.
I don't want the kid to go to prison for the rest of his life, but to walk away after what he did is not fair. There should be something in between, some lesser form of punishment.
I agree. But what is it? Jake asked.
I'm not sure. But I do know something about the insanity defense because of Carl Lee. He wasn't insane, and he got off. Drew seems far more traumatized and detached from reality than Carl Lee.
I agree again. Carl Lee knew exactly what he was doing when he killed those two. He planned it carefully and carried it out perfectly. His defense was not about his mental state. It was about sympathy from the jury. It will all come down to the jury, as always.
And how do you make the jurors sympathetic?
Jake glanced over his shoulder. Hannah and Mully were fast asleep. Softly, he said, "The pregnant sister."
And the dead mother?
The dead mother will be a powerful element and will use it continually. However, she wasn't dead. She was still breathing. With a pulse, and the prosecution will make much of that. The kids should have known that Josie wasn't dead.
Come on, Jake. Two kids, absolutely terrified, probably hysterical because their mother was unconscious and not responsive, once again beaten by a brute. It seems to me that was quite reasonable to believe she was dead.
That's what I'll tell the jury.
Okay. What's the third scenario? A hung jury?
Yes. A few of the jurors are sympathetic and refuse to go along with capital murder. They want something less, but the majority digs in and wants a gas chamber. Deliberations could be a free-for-all as the jury completely deadlocks and hangs itself. After a few days, Noose has no choice but to declare a mistrial and sends everybody home. Drew goes back to his cell and waits for the retrial.
And how likely is that?
You tell me. Put yourself on the jury. You already know the facts. There aren't many of them.
Why do you always put me on the jury?
Jake chuckled. He was guilty again. A hung jury would be a big win. A guilty verdict is more likely. A not guilty by reason of insanity is a long shot. Carla watched the hills pass. They were on an interstate somewhere in Georgia, and she wasn't finished. She turned around again and checked on Hannah, then said softly,
"Josie promised you there will not be an abortion, right?"
She did, reluctantly. Plus, it's too late.
"So there'll be a baby in September, assuming nature cooperates, and Kira seems to be doing well and seeing a doctor."
"Yes, we're paying for some of that."
"And she has agreed to an adoption."
"You were there when she did. Josie is demanding it. She knows who'd end up raising the kid, and right now, she can barely feed Kira and herself." Carla took a deep breath and looked at her husband.
Have you thought about adopting the child?
As a lawyer?
No, as a father.
Jake almost gasped, and there was a slight jerk on the wheel. He looked at her in utter amazement, shook his head, and said,
Well, no. I have not thought about it.
Obviously, you have.
Can we talk about it?
What don't we talk about? Both turned to check on Hannah.
Well,
Carla said, in that tone that meant that the discussion they were about to have would be complicated. Jake stared straight ahead and ran through his own quick list of complications.
We talked about adoption years ago, and then for some reason, I can't really remember, we just stopped talking. Hannah was a toddler. The doctors had told us that we were lucky to get pregnant with her after some false starts, and that it would not happen again. We wanted at least one more, maybe two.
I remember. I was there.
I guess we just got busy with life and became content with an only child.
Very content.
But the baby will need a good home, Jake.
I'm sure they'll find one. I do several private adoptions a year, and there's always a demand for babies.
We would have the inside track, Jake, don't you think?
I think there are at least two big issues here. Most important, are we as a family ready to expand? Do you, at the age of 37, want another baby?
I think so.
What about Hannah? How will she react?
She'll absolutely adore a little brother.
Brother?
Yes. Kira told Meg 2 days ago that it's a boy.
And why wasn't I informed?
It's girl talk, Jake, and you're always too busy. Think about it, Jake. A little boy with a big sister almost 10 years older.
Why am I suddenly thinking about diapers and walking the floor at night?
They outgrow that. The worst part of having a child is giving birth.
I rather enjoyed it.
Easy for you to say. Now we can avoid all that.
They were quiet for several miles as both plotted their next moves. Jake was reeling and trying to organize his thoughts. Carla had planned the attack and was prepared for any resistance. He seemed to relax, and then he smiled at his adorable wife.
When exactly did you start thinking about this?
I don't know. I've been mulling it over for some time. At first, I thought it was a ridiculous idea, and I thought of all the reasons to let it go. You're the de facto attorney for the family. How would it look for you to use your inside position to get the baby? How would the town react?
That's the least of my worries.
What type of relationship, if any, would the child have with Kira and Josie? What about the Kofers? I'm sure they'll be horrified when they learn that Stuart left a grandchild behind. I doubt if they'll want anything to do with the child, but you never know. I've thought of a lot of issues and a lot of reasons not to do it. But then I keep thinking about the child. Someone, some lucky couple somewhere, will get the magical phone call. They'll drive to the hospital and leave with a little baby boy. It will be all theirs. Why can't it be us, Jake? We're just as qualified as anyone else.
From the rear seat, a sweet, sleepy little voice said,
Anybody thinking about a potty break?
Jake quickly said, We are now, and began looking at exit signs. They were on the beach at dusk, ambling along in the surf with Hannah splashing and chattering nonstop as she held hands with both grandparents. Jake and Carla held hands too and fell behind, happy at the sight of their little girl being smothered in love. Carla wanted to talk, but Jake was not ready for another discussion about expanding the family.
I have an idea, she said.
I'm sure you're about to share it. Ignoring him, she said,
Drew is sitting in jail every day, falling further behind in his education. He's been there since the end of March with no tutoring. Josie said he's already 2 years behind.
At least.
Could you arrange for me to go to the jail 2 or 3 days a week and tutor the kid?
Do you have the time?
I have the summer, Jake. And I can always find the time. We can ask your mother to keep Hannah. She never says no. And we can also find a babysitter to help.
Or I can babysit. The way my practice is drying up, I'll have plenty of time.
Seriously, I can get the textbooks from the school and at least get him on some type of schedule.
I don't know. Ozzy would have to approve it. And he's not too cooperative these days. Maybe I can ask Judge Noose.
Would it be safe? I've never been to the jail.
You're lucky. I'm not sure I like the idea. You'd be close to some rough characters, and you'd be around some cops who are not my best friends these days. Ozzy would have to take some precautions, and he'd probably balk.
Would you talk to him?
Sure, if that's what you want.
No chance he could leave the jail for a few hours each week to meet somewhere else?
Not a chance. Hannah and her grandparents had turned around and were getting close. Mrs. McCullough said,
"How about a glass of wine while I get dinner ready?"
"Sounds delightful," Jake said. "We've eaten 2 meals in the car today, and I'm ready for some real food."
Chapter 26. After 5 days of walking the beach, swimming, reading, sleeping late, and napping, and getting slaughtered in chess by Mr. McCullough, Jake was ready for a break. Early on the morning of May 31st, he hugged Carla, said goodbye to his in-laws, and happily drove away, eager to spend the next 5 hours in blissful solitude. The Kids Advocacy Foundation had an office on M Street near Farragut Square in central Washington. The building was a 1970s-style block of gray brick with 5 floors and far too few windows. The directory in the lobby listed the names of dozens of associations, nonprofits, coalitions, federations, brotherhoods, and so on. Everything from American Raisin Growers to the Disabled Rural Mail Carriers. Jake got off the elevator on the 4th floor and found the right door. He stepped inside to a cramped reception room where a small, dapper gentleman of about 70 sat behind a neat desk and greeted him with a smile.
"You must be Mr. Brigance, all the way from Mississippi."
"I am, yes," Jake said, stepping forward with an outstretched hand.
"I'm Roswell, the boss around here," he said, standing.
He wore a tiny red bow tie and a crisp white shirt.
"A pleasure to meet you."
They shook hands. Jake, in khakis and a button-down, no tie, no socks, said, "And nice to meet you."
"You drove up from the beach, right?"
"Yes." Jake glanced around and took in the decor. The walls were covered with framed portraits of young people in prison whites and jail coveralls, some looking out from behind bars, others in handcuffs.
"Welcome to our headquarters," Roswell said with another cheerful smile. "That's quite a case you have down there. I've read your summaries. Libby expects us to read everything."
He waved at a door as he spoke.
"She's waiting."
Jake followed him into a hallway, and they stopped at the 1st door. Roswell said,
"Libby, Mr. Brigance is here. Mr. Brigance, meet the real boss, Libby Provine."
Ms. Provine was waiting in front of her desk and quickly offered a hand.
"A pleasure, Mr. Brigance. Mind if I call you Jake? We're quite informal around here."
The accent was thick Scottish. The first time they had spoken on the phone, Jake struggled to handle the brogue. "Jake's fine. Nice to meet you." Roswell disappeared, and she pointed to a small conference table in the corner of her office.
"I thought you might want some lunch."
On the table were 2 deli sandwiches on paper plates and bottles of water.
"Lunch is served," she said.
They took their places at the table, but neither made a move for the food.
"An easy drive?" she asked.
"Uneventful. I was happy to get away from the beach and the in-laws." Libby Provine was about 50, with red curly hair that was graying, and she wore sleek designer frames that made her almost attractive. From his research, he knew she had founded the nonprofit 20 years earlier, not long after she finished law school at Georgetown. KAF, as it was known, had a staff of paralegals and four lawyers, all in-house. Its mission was to assist in the defense of teenagers on trial for serious crimes, and more specifically, to try and rescue them during the sentencing phase after they had been convicted. After a few minutes of chit-chat, with neither reaching for the sandwiches, though Jake was starving, Libby asked,
"And you expect the state to proceed with capital murder?"
"Oh, yes. We have a hearing in 2 weeks on the issue, but I do not expect to win. The state is going full speed ahead."
"Even though Kofler was not actually on duty?"
"That's the issue. As you know, the statute was changed 2 years ago, and the new one is hard to ignore."
"I know. Such a needless change of law. What's it called? The Death Penalty Enhancement Act. As if the state needed more muscle in its quest to fill up death row. Total rubbish."
She knew everything. Jake had spoken to her twice on the phone and sent a 40-page review that he and Portia had put together. He had talked to two other lawyers, one in Georgia, one in Texas, who had relied on KAF at trial, and their opinions were glowing. She said,
"Only Mississippi and Texas allow the death penalty for the killing of an officer, regardless of whether he was on duty. It makes no sense."
"We're still fighting the war down there. I'm starving.
Chicken salad or turkey and Swiss?"
"I'll take the chicken salad." They unwrapped the sandwiches and took a bite, hers much smaller than his. She said,
"We dug up some newspaper reports about the Haley trial. Sounds like a real show."
"You could call it that.
Looks like the insanity defense worked for a man who wasn't insane."
"It was all about race, something that will not be a factor with Gamble."
"And your expert, Dr. Bass?"
"I wouldn't dare use him again. He's a drunk and a liar, and I used him only because he was free. We got lucky. Have you found us the right expert?" She nibbled on the crust of her sandwich and nodded.
"You'll need at least two experts, one for the insanity defense, which I believe is all you have, and one for sentencing, assuming he's convicted. That's where we can help. Virtually all of our clients are guilty, and some of their crimes are pretty horrific. We just try to keep them alive and out of prison for the rest of their lives."
Jake had a mouthful, so he just nodded. Libby, apparently, was a light eater. She continued,
"One day in this great land, the Supreme Court will rule that sending juveniles to death row is cruel and unusual punishment. But we're not there yet. The court may also see the light and rule that sentencing kids to prison for life without parole is nothing but a death sentence. Again, we're not there yet. So we soldier on."
She finally took another bite. Jake had asked for money and manpower, money for expert testimony and litigation expenses, and he wanted the assistance of another seasoned lawyer in the second chair during the trial. The law required a second defense lawyer, but Noose was having trouble finding one. Jake had made these requests in writing, and they had discussed them over the phone. KAF lawyers were overworked. Its funds were tight. He had driven 5 hours for the meeting to say hello and impress upon Libby Provine the urgency of Drew's case. Perhaps a face-to-face meeting would lead to her cooperation. Two other requests to similar organizations were pending, but did not look promising. She said,
"We've used a child psychiatrist from Michigan in a number of cases, a Dr. Emile Jambla. He's the best so far. A Syrian, slightly darker skin, speaks with an accent. Might this be a problem down there?"
"Oh, yes. Could be a real problem. Anybody else?"
"Our second choice would be a doctor out of New York."
"Got anybody with the right accent?"
"Maybe. There's one who's on the faculty at Baylor."
"Now you're talking. You know how experts work in courtrooms, Libby.
He or she needs to be from another state because the farther he or she has traveled to get there, the smarter he or she is perceived to be by the jury. On the other hand, people down there react strongly to strange accents, especially northern ones.
I know. I tried a case in Alabama 10 years ago. Can you imagine me talking to a jury in Tuscaloosa? It was not a good outcome. The kid was 17. Now he's 27 and still on death row.
I think I read that case.
What will your jury look like?
Frightening. A regular posse. It's rural North Mississippi, and I'll try to change venue to another county simply because of the notoriety. But wherever we go, the demographics are much the same. 75% white, average household income of $30,000. I expect 9 or 10 whites, 2 or 3 blacks, 7 women, 5 men, ages 30 to 60, all Christians or claiming to be. Of the 12, maybe 4 made it to college. 4 didn't finish high school. 1 person earning $50,000 a year. 2 or 3 unemployed. God-fearing souls who believe in law and order.
I've seen that jury. Is the trial still set for August the 6th?
It is, and I don't see a delay.
Why so soon?
Why not? And I have a good reason for warning the trial on August 6th. I'll explain in a moment.
Okay. How do you see it unfolding?
Fairly cut and dried, to a point. The state will go first, of course. The prosecutor is competent, but inexperienced. He'll begin with the investigators, crime scene photos, cause of death, autopsy, and so on. The facts are plain, unambiguous. The photos are horrendous. So he'll have the jury in his pocket at the opening bell. The victim was an Army veteran, a fine peace officer, a local boy, all that. The case is really not that complicated. Within minutes, the jury will know the victim and his killer and see the murder weapon. During cross-examination, I'll ask about the autopsy and drag out the truth that at the time of his death, Mr. Kofor was blind drunk. That will begin the ugly process of putting him on trial, and it'll get worse. Some of the jurors will resent this. Others will be shocked. At some point, the state will probably call the sister, Kira, to the stand. She is an important witness, and she'll be expected to say that she heard the gunshot and her brother admitted to killing Kofor. The DA will attempt to prove that his actions and movements before the shooting show that the kid knew what he was doing. It was revenge. He thought his mother was dead, and he wanted revenge.
Sounds believable.
Indeed it does. But Kira's testimony could be even more dramatic. When she takes the stand, the jury and everybody else in the courtroom will know immediately that she is pregnant, over 7 months along. And guess who the father is?
Not Kofor.
Yes. I'll ask her to identify the father, and she'll testify, rather emotionally, I suspect, that he was raping her on a regular basis, 5 or 6 times, beginning around Christmas. Whenever they were alone, he raped her. And after each assault, he threatened to kill her and her brother if she told anyone. Libby was speechless. She shoved her sandwich a few inches away and closed her eyes. After a moment, she asked,
"Why would the state put her on the stand if she's pregnant?"
"Because the state doesn't know it." She took a deep breath, moved her chair back, stood and walked to the other end of her office. From behind her desk, she asked,
"Don't you have an obligation to inform the prosecutor?"
"No. She's not my witness. She's not my client."
"I'm sorry, Jake, but I'm having some trouble processing this. Are you trying to hide the fact that she's pregnant?"
"Let's just say I don't want the other side to know it."
"But won't the DA and its investigators meet with their witnesses before trial?"
"Normally, yes. It's up to them. They can meet with her whenever they want. They talked to her 2 weeks ago in my office."
"Is the girl in hiding? Does she have friends?"
"Not many, and yes, she's basically in hiding. I explained to Kira and Josie that it would be best if no one knows she's pregnant. But there's always the chance that she'll be discovered. There's also the chance that the DA will find out. But she's going to testify at trial, either for the prosecution or the defense, and if the trial's in August, she'll be 7 months pregnant.
Is she a showing?
Barely. Her mother has told her to wear nothing but oversized clothing. They're still living in the church, but I'm trying to find them a place, an apartment in another town. They stopped attending church services a couple of weeks ago and are trying to avoid everyone.
At your recommendation, I'm sure.
Jake smiled and nodded. Libby paced back to the table and sat down. She drank from her bottle and said,
"Wow.
I thought you'd like it. A defense lawyer's dream. A total ambush of the prosecution's witness.
I know discovery is limited down there, but this seems a bit extreme."
As I said in my memo, there is virtually no discovery in criminal cases. Same for most of the country. She knew this. She took a bite of her sandwich and chewed slowly, her mind racing.
What about a mistrial? Surely the state will scream about the surprise and want a new trial.
The state rarely gets a mistrial. We've gone back 80 years and researched hundreds of cases involving mistrials. Only 3 were granted to the prosecution, and all involved important witnesses who didn't show up for court. And I'll argue that a mistrial is unnecessary because the girl would testify at trial regardless of which side calls her as a witness.
Any chance Kofar is not the father?
Doubtful. She's 14 and swears he was the first and only. Libby shook her head and looked away. When she looked back, Jake noticed moisture in her eyes.
"She's just a baby," she said softly.
"A sweet girl who's had a tough life."
"You know, Jake, these are terrible trials. I've been through dozens of them in many states. Kids who commit murder are not like adults who commit murder. Their brains have not fully formed. They are easily influenced. They are often abused and mistreated and cannot escape bad environments. Yet, they're able to pull the trigger, same as an adult, and the victims are just as dead. Their survivors are just as angry. This is your first, right?"
"Yes, and I didn't ask for it."
"I know. As bad as these trials are, this is my work, my calling, and I'm still challenged by it. I love the courtroom, Jake, and I really don't want to miss the moment when Kira takes the stand. Talk about drama of the highest order."
"Does this mean?"
"I want to be there. I have a trial in Kentucky in early August, but we'll push for a continuance. Our other lawyers are booked. Maybe, just maybe, I can clear my schedule and step in."
That would help considerably. Jake could not suppress a smile. "What about the money?"
"We're broke, same as always. We'll cover my time and expenses, and we'll provide the expert if and when we get to the sentencing. I'm afraid you're on your own to hire the right insanity person."
"Any ideas?"
"Well, sure," she said. "I know plenty of them. White, black, brown, male, female, young or old. Take your pick. I'll find the right one. Just let me think about it."
"Definitely white. Probably female, don't you think? Our best chance for a little mercy might come from women. Someone who's been slapped around by a drunk. Someone carrying a dark secret about being sexually assaulted. Someone with a teenage daughter."
"We keep a thick file on the best experts."
"Don't forget about the accent."
"Of course not. In fact, there's a shrink in New Orleans we used about 3 years ago. I wasn't in the courtroom, but our lawyers were impressed. So was the jury."
"How much might this expert cost me?"
$20,000, give or take."
"I don't have $20,000.
I'll see what I can do."
Jake offered a hand to shake and said, "Welcome to Ford County, though let's hope the trial is somewhere else." She shook his hand and said,
"Deal."
Chapter 27. The investigator for the district attorney was a former Tyler County deputy named Jerry Snook. On a Monday morning, he arrived for work at the DA's office in the courthouse in Gretna and began planning his week.
15 minutes later, he was summoned to Lowell Dyer's office next door. His boss was already in a foul mood. Dyer said, "Just got off the phone with Earl Cofer, who calls me at least 3 times a week. Wanted to know what he always wants to know. When's the trial?" I said, "August the 6th, same as the last time you called. The date is set and will not be moved. Wanted to know if the trial will be in Ford County. I said, I don't know because Brigance wants to move it." "Why?" he asked. "Because he thinks there's too much notoriety around Clanton and is looking for a friendlier venue. He wants a jury that's not familiar with the case." This upset Earl, and he started cussing, said the system is always rigged to protect the criminal. I explained that we will resist any effort to move the case, but the decision will be left to Judge Noose. He ranted about Brigance and the Carl Lee Haley trial and said the system wasn't fair because he got off by claiming to be insane, and that's what Brigance will do again. I reminded him that Judge Noose refused to change venue in that trial, and it's been a long time since he agreed to move one. I explained that it's rare in Mississippi for a judge to change venue and so on. But he doesn't listen and is really bitter, which I understand. He wants me to guarantee that the kid will be convicted and sent to death row. And he wanted to know when there will be an execution. He said he read somewhere that Mississippi has plenty of men on death row, but can't seem to get them to the gas chamber. Said the average time on death row is 18 years. Said he can't wait that long, that his family is devastated, and on. The same conversation we had last Friday. "Sorry, boss," Snook said. Dyer moved some papers around on his desk. "Oh, well, just part of the job, I guess." "You wanted to talk about the mother and sister." "Yes, primarily the sister. We need to talk to them now. We have a general idea of what Josie will say at trial, but we will not call her as a witness. The girl, though, has to testify. We have to assume that the defendant will not take the stand, so we have to call his sister. What do you know about them as of today?" "They're still living in the church. Josie is working at least 2 part-time jobs. Don't know what the girl is doing. She's a kid and school's out." "We can't talk to her unless her mother is present. I mean, we could, in theory, but it would cause problems. Brigance would get involved and raise hell. It looks like they're doing whatever he says." "I don't mind knocking on the door when Josie's gone." Dyer was shaking his head. "She'll freak out and call her mother. It's too risky. I'll call Brigance and arrange a meeting." "Good luck with that." "The trial's in 2 months. Are you ready?"
"I will be."
"When are you headed to Ford County?"
"Tomorrow."
"Stop by and say hello to Earl Cofer. The family needs to be reassured."
"Would love to."
Jake and Carla parked in front of the jail and walked in the front door. He had his briefcase. She was carrying a large cloth bag filled with textbooks and notepads. Inside, Jake spoke to 2 deputies he knew, but did not introduce his wife. The mood was immediately tense, and the greetings were strained. He led Carla through a door to the jail and stopped at the counter where Sergeant Buford was waiting on them. Jake said, "Ozzie told us to be here at 9. Judge Noose's orders." Buford glanced at his watch as if Jake couldn't tell time.
"I need to look at that,"
he said, pointing to Jake's briefcase. Jake opened it for a quick inspection. Satisfied but not pleased with the encounter, Buford looked at Carla's bag and asked,
"What's in there?"
She opened it and said,
"Textbooks and notepads."
He poked around without removing anything and growled,
"Follow me."
Though Jake had reassured her, Carla's stomach was in knots. She had never been inside the jail and half expected to see real criminals leering at her through the bars.
But there were no cells, only a dank, narrow hallway with worn carpet and doors on both sides. They stopped at one, and Buford unlocked it with one of the many keys on his ring.
Ozzy said 2 hours. I'll be back at 11.
I'd like to leave in an hour, Jake said. Buford shrugged, as if he could not care less, and opened the door. With a jerk of the head, he motioned for them to step inside and then locked the door behind them. Drew was sitting at a small table in the same faded coveralls he wore every day. He did not stand or say hello. His hands were free, and he'd been playing with a deck of cards. Jake said, "Drew, this is my wife, Miss Brigance, but you can call her Miss Carla." Drew smiled, because it was impossible not to smile at Carla. They sat in metal chairs across the narrow table. Carla smiled and said, "Nice to meet you, Drew." Jake said, "Now, Drew, as I explained yesterday, Miss Carla will visit you twice a week and organize a plan for your schoolwork."
"Okay,"
Carla said.
"Jake tells me you were in the 9th grade last year, right?"
"Uh-huh."
With a smile, Jake said, "Drew, I want you to get in the habit of saying yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Yes, sir, and no, sir would be a good thing, too. Can you practice this?"
"Yes, sir."
"Attaboy." Carla said,
"I checked with your teachers, and they told me your subjects were Mississippi History, Algebra 1, English, and General Science. Does that sound right?"
"I guess so."
"Do you have a favorite subject?"
"Not really. I didn't like any of them. I hate school."
The teachers had verified this. They were unanimous in their assessment that he was indifferent to his studies, barely made passing grades, had few friends, kept to himself, and in general seemed miserable at school. Carla's first impression was similar to Jake's. It was difficult to believe that the kid was 16 years old. 13 would have been a good guess. He was frail, skinny, with a mop of blonde hair that badly needed trimming. He was awkward, timid, and avoided eye contact. The thought that he had committed such a heinous murder was hard to fathom. She said,
"Okay, a lot of kids hate school, but you can't drop out. Let's just say that this is not school. Let's call it private tutoring. What I want to do is take about 30 minutes with each subject and then leave you with some homework."
"Homework sounds like school,"
Drew said, and they laughed. For Jake, it was a minor breakthrough, the first attempt at humor he had seen by his client.
"I guess it does. Where would you like to start?"
He shrugged and said,
"I don't care. You're the teacher."
"Okay. Let's start with math."
Drew frowned and Jake mumbled, "Not my favorite either." Carla reached into her bag, pulled out a notebook, and placed it on the table. She opened it and removed a single sheet of paper.
"Here are 10 basic math problems I want you to do for me."
She handed him a pencil. The problems were simple sums that any 5th grader could handle in a matter of minutes. To ease the pressure, Jake removed a file from his briefcase and was soon lost in something lawyerly. Carla pulled out a history textbook and thumbed through it. Drew went to work and did not appear to struggle. His academic progress had been uneven, to say the least. In his young life, he had attended at least 7 schools in different districts and states. He had dropped out at least twice and transferred numerous times. He had lived in 3 foster homes, 1 orphanage, with 2 relatives, in a borrowed camper, spent 4 months in a juvenile jail for stealing bikes, and there had been stretches of homelessness in which there had been no school at all. His most stable period had been from the ages of 11 to 13, when his mother was in prison and he and Kira were sent to a Baptist orphanage in Arkansas, where they found structure and security. Once paroled, Josie reclaimed her children, and the family continued its chaotic journey to somewhere. With Josie's written consent, Portia had doggedly tracked down his school records and Kira's as well and put together their sad little biographies. Jake, while pretending to read with a frown, was thinking of how far his client had come in the past 11 weeks. From his catatonic state in their first meetings, through his first words, his 2 weeks at Whitfield, his forced acceptance of solitary confinement, and the dreariness of life in a cell, to a point now where he could maintain a decent conversation and ask about his future. There was little doubt the antidepressants were working. It also helped that Mr. Zack, another jailer, liked him and spent time with him. He brought the kid chocolate brownies baked by his wife and comic books, and he gave Drew a deck of cards and taught him gin rummy, poker, and blackjack. When things were slow, Mr. Zack went down to his little room for a hand or two. Human contact was crucial for everyone, and Mr. Zack loathed the notion of solitary confinement. Jake was stopping by almost every day. They often played cards and talked about the weather, girls, friends, games that Drew once played. Anything but the killing and the trial. Jake was still not ready to ask his client the most important question. Did you know Kofor was raping Kira? And that was because Jake was not ready for the answer. If it was yes, then revenge was in play, and revenge meant that Drew acted with forethought to protect her. Forethought equaled premeditation, and that meant the death penalty. Perhaps he would never ask the question. He still had serious reservations about putting Drew on the stand to face a withering cross-examination by the district attorney. As Jake watched him do the math, he could not imagine allowing the kid to be sacrificed in front of the jury. It was a decision any defense lawyer had the right to reserve until the last moment. Mississippi did not require the defense to divulge before the trial whether or not the accused would testify. Jake had hinted to Judge Noose and Lowell Dyer that Drew would not, but that was part of a ploy to force the prosecution to call Kira as a witness. Other than her brother, she was the only possible eyewitness. Drew said, "Here," and handed Carla the sheet of paper. She smiled, handed him another, and said, "Okay, now try these." It was another series of slightly more difficult sums. As he worked, Carla graded the first set. He'd missed 4 out of 10. She had her work cut out for her. Buford was back after an hour, and Jake was ready to leave. He asked Drew to stand, shake hands firmly, and say goodbye. Carla was preparing a brief lesson on the Native Americans who once lived in their state. Jake left the jail on foot and walked 3 blocks to the square for a meeting he wanted to avoid. He entered Security Bank, waited 5 minutes in the lobby, and soon saw Stan at Cabbage waving him into his spacious office. They exchanged greetings like the good friends they were, but both were dreading what they were about to discuss. "Let's cut to the chase, Stan," Jake finally said.
"Right. Look, Jake, as I've said before, this is not the same bank it was 2 years ago. Back then, we were locally owned, and Ed gave me plenty of wiggle room. I could do almost anything I wanted. But as you know, Ed sold out, and he's gone now, and the new guys down in Jackson run a different show. We've had this discussion, and we're having it again. We've been good friends for many years, and I'd do anything within my power to help you. But I'm not calling all the shots anymore."
"How much do they want?"
"They don't like this loan, Jake. Lending money for litigation. They refer to it as tort sport money, and they said no at first. I convinced them that you knew what you're doing, and you were certain Smallwood would be a gold mine. Now that the case has blown up, they feel vindicated. They want half of the $70,000, and they want it real soon. And so that leads us to my request for a refinancing. If the bank will redo the mortgage on my home, extend more credit, I'll have some cash to work with. I can pay down the litigation loan and stay in business.
Well, your business model worries them. They've gone through your financials and are not impressed. The idea of a bunch of big-shot bankers poking through his financials and frowning at his income made his blood boil. He hated banks and once again vowed to somehow get them out of his life. At the moment, though, that seemed impossible. Stan continued, "Last year, you grossed $90,000 and netted $50,000 before taxes. I know this. Believe me, I do. But the year before, I grossed $140,000. You know what it's like hustling clients in a small town. With the exception of the Sullivans, every lawyer around the square is up and down. True, but the year before, you were sitting fat because of fees from the Hubbard Will contest." "I really don't want to argue with you, Stan. I bought the house 2 years ago from Willie Traynor for $250,000. A lot for Clanton, but then it's a lot of house. And I approve the loan without hesitation. But the guys in Jackson are skeptical of your appraisal. You and I both know the appraisal is on the high side. I bet those sumbitches down in Jackson live in homes that cost a lot more than $300,000. That's beside the point, Jake. They're saying no to a new mortgage. I'm sorry, Jake. If it were up to me, I would approve the loan to you with just your signature, no collateral. Let's not get carried away here, Stan. You are, after all, a banker. I'm your friend, Jake, and it pains me to pass along the bad news. Zero. No new mortgage. I'm sorry, Jake." Jake sighed in defeat and almost felt sorry for his friend. They watched each other for a moment. Jake finally said, "Okay, I'll shop it around. When do they want their money?" 2 weeks. Jake shook his head as if in disbelief. "I guess I can dip into the rather shallow pool of my savings." "I'm sorry, Jake." "I know you are, Stan. And I know this is not what you want. Don't beat yourself up over it. I'll survive. Somehow." They shook hands, and Jake couldn't wait to get out of the bank. He used the back alleys to avoid people and minutes later eased into his office. More bad news was waiting. Josie was sitting with Portia at the front desk. Both were drinking coffee and seemed engaged in a pleasant conversation. She had not bothered to make an appointment, and Jake was not in the mood for more hand-holding. But he couldn't say no. She followed him upstairs to his office and sat across from him at his cluttered desk. They talked about Drew for a moment, and Jake reported that Carla was over at the jail going through their initial tutoring session. He exaggerated a little and said Drew seemed to be enjoying the attention. They talked about Kira for a moment, and Josie described her as lonely, bored, and frightened. Mrs. Golden from the church visited 3 times a week for lessons. She was piling on the homework, and this kept Kira somewhat engaged. Charles and Meg McGarry stopped by every other day to check on her. Josie had stopped going to church because Kira couldn't go with her anymore. She was finally showing a little, and their secret had to be protected. Josie pulled some letters out of her purse and handed them over. She said, "Two from the hospitals, here and in Tupelo, and one from the doctor over there. A total of $16,000 in change. And of course, they're making threats. What am I supposed to do, Jake?" Jake quickly scanned the numbers and once again marveled at the cost of health care. She said, "I'm working 3 part-time jobs now, all minimum wage, and we're barely getting by. But I can't pay these bills. Plus, my car needs a new transmission. If it croaks, we're just screwed, plain and simple." Jake said, "We can bankrupt these." He avoided bankruptcy work with as much enthusiasm as he avoided divorces, but occasionally he waded into the pit with a client in dire need. "But I need my doctor, Jake. I can't bankrupt him. Plus, I filed 2 years ago down in Louisiana for the second time. Isn't there a limit on how many times you can file?" "I'm afraid so.
With her financial problems, criminal convictions, and divorces, he figured she knew more about the law than most lawyers. While he admired her spunk and determination to survive and protect her children, he fought the urge to judge her harshly for her mistakes.
So I can't file again. What do you suggest?
He wanted to suggest that she go hire herself another lawyer. He had his hands full with her son, and that would probably drive himself into bankruptcy. He had never agreed to represent her. On the contrary, he had been strong-armed into defending Drew. But he was the family's lawyer, and there was no way out of it. Harry Rex would run her off, shoo her out of the office, and show little sympathy. Lucian would take her in and then dump her problems on the desk of some lowly associate while he mounted a noisy defense of her son. Jake didn't have that luxury. And the truth was that he rarely said no to an indigent client in need. At times it seemed that half of his work was pro bono, either agreed on up front or realized months later when his fees were written off. Complicating matters was the ticking clock. Kira would have a baby in about 3 months. His conversations with Carla were still fresh. Okay, I'll call the hospitals and doctors and have a chat. She was wiping her eyes.
You ever had your paycheck garnished, Jake?
What paycheck? No, I haven't.
It's awful. You work hard at a crap job, and when you finally get paid, there's a yellow notice in the envelope. Some credit card company or finance company or crooked used car dealer has snagged your paycheck and cut it in half. It's just awful. That's the way I live, Jake. Always climbing a mountain, trying to keep food on the table, and there's always somebody after me, writing mean letters, hiring collection lawyers, threatening. Somebody's always threatening. I don't mind working hard, but I'm just trying to stay afloat, to survive. I can't even think about getting ahead.
It was easy to think that her problems were all self-imposed, the damage self-inflicted. But Jake wondered if she had ever really had a chance. She had lived for 32 hard years. If given the chance, she could be attractive. And this had no doubt led to serious problems with bad men. Perhaps she had been abused, or perhaps she had always made wrong decisions. I'll make the calls and buy some time, he said, because he could think of nothing else and needed to do some work, hopefully something that paid. She blurted,
I need $800 for a transmission, Jake, a used one. Can you make me a loan?
In the life of a small-town lawyer, this was not an unusual request. Jake had learned the hard way to avoid lending money to broke clients. The standard and trusted response was, sorry, but it's unethical for me to loan money to you. Why? Why? Because the chances of getting repaid are rather slim. Why? Because the ethics people down at the State Bar Association realized decades ago that most of its members, the majority of whom are small-town lawyers, need to be protected from such requests. At the moment, he had about $4,000 in his firm account, money that would be sorely needed in the forthcoming months to keep his doors open. But what the hell? She needed the money far more than he did. And if her car quit, he would inherit even more problems he didn't want to deal with. He could work longer hours, hustle more clients, ask Noose to give him indigent appointments that he could ramp up and obtain plea bargains. He was proud to be a street lawyer, as opposed to those stiff suits in the big firms, and he had always been able to hustle for extra work when in a pinch. He smiled and nodded and said, I can swing that. I'll ask you to sign a promissory note with a due date a year from now. It's sort of a formality for ethical reasons. She wept for a while as Jake pretended to take notes. When the crying finally stopped, she said,
I'm sorry, Jake. So sorry.
He waited until she was somewhat composed and said, Josie, I have an idea. You're tired of living in the church. Pastor McGarry and his flock have been amazing in their support for you and Kira. But you can't stay there. They'll soon realize she's pregnant, and the gossip will begin. You can't pay these bills, and it's unrealistic to think the hospitals and doctors will back off. I want you to disappear, to move, to simply vanish from this area.
I can't leave. Not with Drew in jail and facing trial.
You can't help Drew right now. Move somewhere not far away and lay low until the trial.
Where?
Oxford. It's only an hour away. It's a college town with lots of cheap apartments. We'll find one that's furnished. Summer is here and the students are gone. I have a couple of lawyer friends there, and I'll lean on them to help find a job or two. Forget these bills. The debt collectors can't find you.
That's the story of my life, Jake. Always running.
There's no reason to stay here. No family. No real friends.
What about Kira's doctor?
They have a nice hospital in Oxford, a regional, with plenty of good doctors. We'll make sure she's taken care of. That's a priority. Her tears were gone. Her eyes clear.
I'll need another loan to get set up.
There's another reason, Josie. She'll have the baby sometime in September, after the trial, and after everyone in Clanton knows about her pregnancy. If she has the baby in Oxford, few people here will know anything about it. Very few, including the Kofers. They'll be shocked when they learn about their grandchild, and they'll probably want nothing to do with it. However, as I've learned, it's impossible to predict what people would do. There's the chance that they might want some contact with the child. That cannot happen.
That will not happen.
We'll do the adoption over there, in another judicial district. Kira will be in another school, and her new friends will know nothing about her pregnancy. Moving away is the best move for her, and for you too.
I don't know what to do, Jake.
You're a survivor, Josie. Get away from this place. Nothing good will happen to you and your daughter if you stay in this county. Trust me on this. She bit her lip and fought back more tears. Softly, she said,
Okay.
Chancellor Reuben Attlee's fine old home was two blocks from Jake's in central Clanton. It was old enough to have its own name, Maple Run, and the judge had lived there for decades. Late in the afternoon, Jake parked behind a large Buick and knocked on the screen door. Attlee was a notorious tightwad who still refused to install air conditioning. A voice called him inside, and Jake stepped into the humid, and sticky foyer. Judge Attlee appeared with two tumblers filled with brown liquid, his standard whiskey sour toddy to end another hard day. He handed one to Jake and said,
Let's sit on the porch.
They went outside where the air was noticeably lighter and settled into rockers. Judge Attlee had ruled the Chancery Court for a long time and quietly kept his nose in most of the county's business. His jurisdiction was family law. All the divorces, adoptions, plus will contests, land disputes, zoning matters, a long list of legal matters that almost never included jury trials. He was wise, fair, heavy-handed, and had no patience with windy or lazy lawyers. He said,
I see you got stuck with a gamble case.
Afraid so. Jake sipped the whiskey, not his favorite, and wondered how he would explain this to Carla. It wouldn't be that difficult. If Judge Attlee handed you a drink and said sit on the front porch, no lawyer could say no.
Noose called me for advice. I said there was no other lawyer in the county who could handle the case.
Thanks for nothing.
It's part of being a lawyer, Jake. You don't always get to choose your clients.
And why not? Why couldn't he and every other lawyer say no to a client?
Well, I'm stuck with it. I suppose you're going with insanity.
Probably.
But he shot him in cold blood.
Such a shame. It's all so tragic. What a waste of life for the deputy and the kid.
I doubt there will be much sympathy for the kid. Atlee took a sip and gazed at the rooftops down the hill. The roof of the Hocut house was visible in the distance.
What's a fair punishment, Jake? I don't like the idea of putting children on trial for capital murder. But the deputy is just as dead regardless of who pulled the trigger. The killer has to be punished, and severely.
That's the great question, isn't it? But it doesn't really matter. The town wants a death verdict and the gas chamber. My job is to fight it. Atlee nodded and took another sip.
You said you needed a favor.
Yes, sir. I don't think it's fair to try the kid in this county. It will be impossible to pick an impartial jury. Do you agree?
I don't deal with juries, Jake. You know that.
Jake also knew that Judge Atlee knew more about the case than all but a handful of people. But you know the county, Judge, better than anyone. I plan to ask for a change of venue, and I need your help.
In what way?
Talk to Noose. You guys have a way of communicating that few people know about. You just said that he called you looking for advice on who to appoint. Lean on him to change venue.
To where?
Anywhere but here. He'll keep jurisdiction because it's his case and it's high profile. Doesn't want to miss the fun. Plus, he might have an opponent next year, and he wants to look good.
Buckley?
That's a rumor. Buckley's making noises down there.
Buckley's a fool, and he got slaughtered in his last election.
True, but no sitting judge wants an election.
I've never had one,
he said a bit too smugly. No lawyer with half a brain would challenge Reuben Atlee. Jake said, Noose refused to change venue in Carl Lee Haley's trial, and his reasoning was that it was so notorious that everybody in the state knew the details. He was probably right. This is different. A dead cop is a big story, tragic and all, but it happens. The headlines go away. I bet the folks up in Melbourne County aren't talking about it.
I was there last week. Not a word.
It's different here. The Kofers have lots of friends. Ozzie and his boys are pissed. They'll keep things stirred up. His Honor was nodding. He took another sip and said,
I'll talk to Noose.
Chapter 28. After another round of verbal abuse from Harry Rex, Stan managed to convince his boss down in Jackson to reduce the payment to $25,000. Jake raided his savings and wrote a check for half. Harry Rex found some money and wrote his own, along with a handwritten note vowing to never speak to Stan again. He stopped just short of threatening to punch him the next time he saw him on the square. Harry Rex was still confident they would get something out of the Smallwood case, if only a nuisance settlement to save the railroad the costs of defending a big trial. When that trial might take place, no one knew. Sean Gilder and the railroad boys were up to their patented stall game and claimed to still be searching for just the right expert. Noose had pushed them hard for over a year, but since Jake's debacle in discovery, he had lost interest in a speedy trial. Gilder's partner, Dobie Pittman, had intimated that the railroad might consider a nuisance settlement to make the case go away. Something like $100,000, he whispered over more drinks in Jackson. In the unlikely event that the railroad and its insurance company did in fact write a check, the litigation expenses, now at $72,000 and change, would be reimbursed first. Whatever was left would be divided, with two-thirds going to Grace Smallwood and one-third to Jake and Harry Rex. The fee would be paltry, but at least they would have dodged a bullet with their ill-fated tort sport loan. However, Dobie Pittman wasn't calling the shots and had been wrong before. Sean Gilder showed no signs of backing off and seemed confident of a glorious courtroom victory. On Friday, June 8th, Lowell Dyer and Jerry Snook, along with Ozzie and his investigator, Kirk Rady, settled into the main conference room of Jake's office suite. Across the table, Jake sat with Josie on one side and Kira on the other. For the meeting, the girl was wearing a pair of loose-fitting jeans and a bulky sweatshirt. Though the temperature was close to 90, no one seemed to notice that the sweatshirt seemed out of place. Jake and Josie assumed that everyone in the room knew that the family was wearing secondhand clothing that had been donated. She was 6 months pregnant, with a small baby bump that was well concealed. After an attempt at a few awkward pleasantries, Dyer began by explaining to Kira that since she was a witness to the crime, she might be called by the state to testify.
"Do you understand this?" he asked somewhat delicately.
She nodded and softly said,
"Yes, I do."
"Has Mr. Brigance explained to you what will happen in court?"
"Yes, we've talked about it."
"Has he told you what to say?"
She shrugged and looked confused.
"I guess."
"So what did Mr. Brigance tell you to say?"
Jake, itching for a fight, interrupted with, "Why don't you just ask her what happened?"
"Okay, Kira, what happened that night?"
Avoiding eye contact, she focused on a legal pad in the center of the table and told her story. Awake at 2 a.m., waiting for Stuart Kofer to return home, hiding in her bedroom with Drew while their mother waited downstairs, unable to sleep because of the fear. Sitting on her bed in the dark with her brother, with the door locked. Seeing the headlights, hearing the car, hearing the kitchen door open and slam, hearing the voices of her mother and Kofer as they argued. Then louder voices as he called her a whore and a liar. The sound of her mother getting slapped around again. Then the silence for a few minutes. As they waited, the heavy footsteps of Kofer climbing the stairs, calling her name as he got closer. The rattling of her doorknob. The banging on the door as they cried and held their breath and prayed for help. The silence for a moment as he decided to leave them alone. The sounds of him going back down the stairs. The horror of knowing their mother was injured, or else she would have been fighting to protect them. The long, awful silence as they waited. Her voice cracked, and she wiped her cheeks with a tissue. Dyer said,
"I realize this is difficult, but please try to finish. This is very important."
She nodded and clenched her jaws in determination. She looked at Jake, and he nodded. "Finish it." Drew eased downstairs and found their mother unconscious. He ran back upstairs and, in tears, said she was dead. They went to the kitchen where Kira begged her mother to wake up. Then she sat down and took her mother's head in her lap. One of them, she couldn't remember who, said to call 911. Drew made the call as Kira held her mother, who wasn't breathing. They knew she was dead. She held her mother's head and stroked her hair and whispered to her. Drew was moving around, but she wasn't sure what he was doing. He said that Kofer was passed out on his bed. Drew closed the bedroom door, and Kira heard the gunshot. She began sobbing, and the adults in the room avoided eye contact. After a minute or two, she wiped her cheeks again and looked at Dyer. He asked,
"What did Drew say after the gunshot?"
"He said he shot Stu."
"So you did not actually see him shoot Stuart?"
"No."
"But you heard the gunshot?"
Yes.
Did Drew say anything else?
She paused and thought about this and finally said,
I don't remember anything else he said.
Okay. What happened next?
Another pause.
I don't know. I was just holding my mother, and I couldn't believe she was dead.
Do you remember a deputy arriving on the scene?
Yes.
And where were you when you saw the deputy?
I was still on the floor, holding my mother.
Do you remember the deputy asking you what happened?
I think so, yes.
And what did you say?
I said something like, Drew shot Stuart.
Dyer offered a sappy smile and said,
Thank you, Kara. I know this is not easy. While you were holding your mother, was she breathing?
No, I didn't think so. I held her for a long time, and I just knew she was dead.
Did you try to check her pulse?
I don't think so. I was too scared. It's kind of hard to think when something like that happens.
I understand.
Dyer looked at some notes and paused before proceeding.
Now, I believe you used the word again when you said that you heard Stuart Kofer and your mother arguing and fighting downstairs. Is this correct?
Yes, sir.
So this had happened before?
Yes, sir, many times.
Did you ever actually see these fights?
Yes, but I wouldn't call them fights. My mother was just trying to protect herself when he beat her.
And you saw this?
One time, yes. He came home late and drunk as usual.
Did he ever hit you or Drew?
Jake interrupted with, She's not answering that.
Why not? Dyer shot across the table.
Because on direct examination, you're not going to ask that question. She'll be your witness then.
I have the right to know what her testimony will be. On direct, when she's your witness, you have no right to know what she might say on cross.
Dyer ignored Jake, looked at Kara, and asked the question again.
Did Stuart Kofer ever hit you or Drew?
Jake said, Don't answer that.
You're not her lawyer, Jake.
But she'll be my witness on cross. Let's just say that her testimony on cross will not be helpful to the state.
You're wrong about this, Jake.
Then we'll have a chat with Judge News.
You're out of line here.
We'll see, but she's not answering that question till the judge orders her to. You got what you want. Now let it go.
I will not. I'll file a motion to compel her to answer my questions.
Fine. And we'll argue your motion before the judge. Dyer made a production of putting the cap back onto his pen and gathering his notes. Meeting over, he said, Thank you, Kara, for your time. Jake, Kara, and Josie didn't move as the rest of them stood and filed out of the room. When the door was closed, Jake patted Kara on the arm and said, Nice job. It was a splendid performance by a 14-year-old girl. Broke as he was, Jake wanted to host a backyard barbecue. Late Friday afternoon, he fired up his grill on the patio, marinated chicken breasts and thighs, and roasted hot dogs and corn on the cob while Carla mixed a large pitcher of lemonade. The Haley clan arrived first, Carl, Lee, and Gwen with their four children, Tanya, now 17 and going on 20, and the three boys, Ernie, Jarvis, and Micah. They always arrived a bit reticent because they were guests at a fine home in the white section of town, a rarity in Clanton. Jake had never been to a barbecue or a cocktail party or even a wedding to which blacks were invited. Since Carl Lee's trial 5 years earlier, he and Carla had been determined to change this. They had hosted the Haleys, along with Ozzie and his family, many times on the patio. And they had been to the Haley's home for cookouts and sprawling family gatherings where they were the only white folks. Among the blacks in Ford County, Jake Brigance could do no wrong. He was their lawyer. The problem was they had little to pay in the way of fees, and most of their legal issues fit in the pro bono category, Jake's specialty. Ozzie had been invited, but found an excuse to stay away. Josie and Kira arrived with Charles and Meg McGarry. Meg was 9 months pregnant and due any moment. Kira was 4 months behind and was still wearing the same bulky sweatshirt, in spite of the heat. Harry Rex was always invited, along with his current wife, but he usually declined because beer was not permitted. Lucian was an occasional guest, and had even brought Sally once, the only time the two were seen together about town. But he, like Harry Rex, couldn't enjoy a barbecue without booze. That, and he took pride in being fiercely antisocial. Stan at Cabbage had once been on the list, but rarely made an appearance. His wife, Tilda, didn't like to mingle with the lower classes. As the kids played badminton, and the women huddled on the patio and fussed over Meg and her due date, Jake and Carl Lee sipped lemonade in lawn chairs in the shade and caught up with the gossip. Lester was always a topic. He was Carl Lee's younger brother and lived in Chicago, where he earned big wages as a union iron worker. His troubles with women were always the source of tall stories and endless humor. When everyone else was preoccupied, Carl Lee said,
"Looks like you've got yourself in another mess."
"You could say that," Jake agreed with a smile.
"When's the trial?"
"August, 2 months away."
"Why don't you put me on the jury?"
"Carl Lee, you're the last person they would put on my jury." They enjoyed the light moment. Carl Lee still worked at a lumber mill and was now a foreman. He owned his home and 5 acres around it, and he and Gwen raised their children in a strict environment with many rules. Church every Sunday, plenty of chores for the kids, homework, and good grades, respect for elders. His mother lived half a mile down the road and saw her grandchildren every day.
"Willie didn't care for Kofa," Carl Lee said.
Willie Hastings was Gwen's second cousin and the first black deputy Ozzie hired.
"I'm not surprised. He had no use for blacks. He sucked up to Ozzie for obvious reasons, but he had a dark side. Real dark. Willie thinks the boy got messed up in the army. They kicked him out, you know."
"I know. A dishonorable discharge. But Ozzie liked him, and he was a good cop."
"Willie says Ozzie knew more than he's letting on. Says all the deputies knew that Kofa was out of control, drinking, drugging, fighting in the clubs."
"That's the rumor."
"Ain't no rumor, Jake. You ever hear a clear in a bar?"
"No."
"It's a fool's game, where a bunch of drunk thugs walk into a tonk that ain't one of theirs. On cue, they start a brawl, start punching folks, and just beat the shit out of everybody there. Then they hit the door and make their escape. Sort of an extreme version of the Friday night fights. It's supposed to be great fun, because you never know what you're gonna find inside the tonk. Maybe a bunch of old men who can't fight. Maybe some real badasses who break bottles and pool sticks."
"And Kofer was into it?"
"Oh, yeah. He and his crowd were known for clearing bars, usually joints outside of the county. A few months back, not long before his demise, they hit a black tonk down in Polk County, just over the line. I guess Kofa, being an upstanding officer of the law, didn't want to get caught in Ford County."
"They raided a black honky-tonk?"
"Yep, according to Willie. Joint called the Moondog."
"I've heard of it. I had a client years ago who was charged in a knife fight down there.
Rough place."
"That's it.
Always a big dice game on Saturday night. Kofa and 4 other white guys came through the door throwing punches and kicking people. Broke up the dice game. Hell of a brawl. Some tough guys, Jake."
"And they made it out alive?"
"Barely. Some dude pulled a piece and shot the walls. White boys scrambled out and got away."
"That's crazy, Carl Lee."
"Crazy as hell. Lucky they all didn't get cut or shot."
"And Willie knew this?"
"Yep, but he's a cop, and he ain't one to rat on another cop. I don't think Ozzie heard about it."
"That's insane."
"Well, Kofa was crazy like that, and he ran with a tough crowd. You gonna use that at trial?"
"I don't know. Hang on." Jake jumped to his feet and walked to the grill where he flipped the chicken and added more sauce.
Pastor McGarry met him there, and eager to get away from the women, followed Jake back to the shade with Carl Lee. The conversation shifted from Stuart Kofor to the badminton game, where Hannah and Tanya, on one side of the net, were having a bad go of it against the three Haley boys on the other side. Finally, Tanya yelled at her father to come play and even things out. Carl Lee happily picked up a racket and joined the fun. At dusk, they gathered around a picnic table and dined on chicken, hot dogs, and potato salad. The talk was of summer things, trips to the lake, fishing, baseball and softball games, family gatherings. The looming murder trial seemed far away.